Aloha and welcome. I hope you're doing well out there. I'm Rick Devins, and this is episode 6 of Esports for Beginners, a limited series here on the Rob Has a Podcast Network. And we've been having a lot of fun digging into the world of esports. On our last episode, we had Alex Golden Boy Mendez, an esports shoutcaster, on. And I'm excited about our next episode. We're digging into the business of esports with CGO. That's the Chief Gaming Officer of Evil Geniuses, Phil Arum. And I am very lucky to have my guest today. She is an Academy Director and Head Coach for 100 Thieves. Kelsey Moser, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on. I have kind of no idea exactly what you want to talk about, but we'll figure it out as we go along, I assume. So
exactly. I have not much of an idea exactly of what I want to talk about either. We'll start out with just getting to know you, and we're going to kind of dig into your backstory. And as we do, I'll learn about esports. We'll have a lot of tangents. So why don't you tell me about what you're doing right now, Kelsey?
Right now I'm being quarantined. So it's currently the off season between spring and summer. So not much is being done except planning for the next split. So we just had our last split where we went to the quarterfinals. Didn't do too well, but I think we probably lost the second best team in the quarterfinal. So I think we have pretty good groundwork going forward. And it's very clear to us, like, kind of the stuff we need to fix. So that's sort of what I'm focusing on, is just making sure, if you will, the lesson plan and the goals of the next split are very, very clear, because we only have like 9 weeks of regular season to prepare for the next round of quarterfinals once Academy gets underway. So.
And in this off season, you're quarantined. Yeah. How much is that messing with your ability to do your job?
So right now, not too much, but in season, it was surprisingly more difficult, I think. A lot of people think of esports as everything is happening online anyway, so it doesn't matter too much. But for sure, it was a little bit weird, because I think there was just a little bit of lack of, like, people's motivation and attitude changes when they're not seeing each other every day. There's a lot of just rolling out of bed, getting on your computer, being like 50-50 focused, if you will. So you have to find some creative workarounds to make sure everyone feels invested and everyone feels like, oh, okay, I got up, I went to my job. I'm sure everyone in every business is experiencing this kind of thing, right? So, yeah.
We are all adjusting together. There's no doubt about that. And so tell me exactly about what you do. Your game is League of Legends, right?
Yep, for sure.
And you're with 100 Thieves. Can you tell me about what 100 Thieves entails?
Sure. So the specific line, I guess, is that 100 Thieves is both a lifestyle and gaming brand, right? So 100 Thieves is a company founded by a person called Nadeshot, who used to compete in professional Call of Duty. And he was more of a personality there than he was, like, necessarily one of the best players ever. Though he did have some really good titles and wins with Optic, but when he started his own team, like the 100 Thieves, they didn't do too well. So it sort of, for him, became more of a lifestyle idea, like, for him to promote his own brand, for him to start building streetwear. And then in the past few years, he started buying teams and competing in multiple games. You have League of Legends, you have Counter-Strike Global Offensive, you have Fortnite. So it's kind of been growing really, really rapidly as a result. So, and everyone's based in Los Angeles off of where we all compete. It's called the Cash App Compound. We're partnered with Cash App, Chipotle, a bunch of really big brands that help us, like, promote our image, make esports seem more accessible, if you will.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I've been learning more and more about how these teams are set up each interview. So 100 Thieves started out as kind of a lifestyle brand, but now it's buying different teams. Are they, what are some of the teams called that are with 100 Thieves?
They'll still be called 100 Thieves.
Okay.
So 100 Thieves has teams that compete in each sport. So obviously we have now 3 League of Legends teams. We have the CSGO team, and we have multiple Fortnite players, and they all just compete under the 100 Thieves brand as the 100 Thieves teams. So
Outstanding. So you mentioned there are three League of Legends teams. How's that breakdown?
So we're unique in that we've fully committed. We're the only organization, big organization in North America that's fully committed to having three tiers of League of Legends teams. One is the main LCS team that competes like with the top 10 North American teams in every week in Los Angeles. Then you have the Academy teams, and every team is like required by the tournament in which they compete in to have an Academy team as the second level. And then the third level is what we have called 100 Thieves Next. And they compete in the amateur scene, which is mostly third-party events all online, just kind of trying to build up players as they get closer and closer to wanting to compete full-time. We have multiple players in high school in that program. So
you're the director and the head coach of the 100 Thieves Academy teams?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So how does that work? Is that kind of like a minor league in baseball? Like some people are going to get called up, some people are going to get sent back down?
Yeah, that's kind of the idea behind it, right? Is that every team has their minor league team, and there's a whole minor league of competition that everyone competes in. So my goal is focused on, you know, player development, getting players ready for the LCS level. So.
That's really interesting. And you mentioned that 100 Thieves is the only big teams out there to be committed to three tiers.
Yeah, it's the only one in North America. So, yeah.
Okay, very cool. So what's that like working with the folks that are in the LCS league and working with the folks in the amateur league? Because you got to go take some of their great players, and then you have to lose, I imagine, some of your great players.
Yeah, so last year there was a lot more swapping around between players between LCS and Academy. It happened a lot, and it was just kind of other situations where you have a groove going and it's like, oh, suddenly this guy is obviously the top league has the most need and is the biggest focus for a very good reason. You know, they make the most money, they have the most sponsorship, whatever. So their performance is going to be the most important to the organization. So if there is something that they think that they can adjust to fix, like if they want to promote one of your players, then you just say, okay, good luck, have fun. I've done my job as best as I can, and you can perform well in the top level. And then you get whatever piece that they sent down, and you have to kind of readjust because there are only five players on each team. So you have to kind of readjust team chemistry and everything after every roster swap. So
people do get sent down from LCS into Academy.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like? I mean, I'm sure it's different situations, but, you know, I talked with Loco Doco and he informed me that there are a lot of egos in esports.
For sure.
What is that like dealing with someone who thinks that they should be LCS maybe?
So I've been kind of fortunate in the players that have spent time in Academy haven't been like too high ego. They've just sort of done what they needed to do. We had a week where last season where basically, I worked with almost every single person on the LCS team because they were just trying a bunch of different roster iterations. And then they all showed up to play and they understood that this was like kind of, this is how I get my job back, right? I'm sure I have heard horror stories, you know, from other teams and other situations of players who show up and are just not, you know, invested. They don't necessarily think that there's a good chance that they can make it back to the LCS, or they think the Academy is beneath them. But so far, I haven't personally encountered that. So.
I'm very curious, are there folks, do you always go up the three tiers and maybe you don't spend as much time in each one if you're great? Or are there folks that come in and you go, oh, this guy is already Academy or he's already LCS?
There will be situations like that, but it's more, yeah, I think especially in North America, just because I don't know how much you've heard about the segregation of the different solo queue ladders or anything like that within League of Legends. So
I haven't. Can we get into it? Is this how you kind of find your players? Because I'm really curious how you're able to do that.
So obviously the game has its own like copy you download and then you play ranked games and you get high rank and you make it to Challenger. And that's sort of where most of the scouting is done. I would say the quality of the solo queue environment in North America is below some of the top three regions right now, which are Korea, China, and Europe. Right?
I want to later get into regions, into North America because I hear there's been some controversy there in the past. But okay, yeah.
And I would say North America's solo queue quality is not as good. So there's like a lot of learning that has to be done that they can't get from solo queue compared to working with, because I've worked with rookies in Europe before as well, when I worked for a European team, and there's just a very big difference in knowledge gap that coming from like a solo queue environment gives
what,
you.
What are some of the big differences?
Just I think the way the matchups are played on North America are kind of suboptimal, so you're not necessarily learning the full extent of the champion. I would say that there's like a lower percentage of ranked play. There's a lot more profitability in streaming and entertainment in North America, like individual entertainment, than in Europe or Korea. And obviously China has just a massive player base to fill in whatever gaps they need. So there's like that kind of issue. And just the idea that like, I feel like League of Legends culture is much more geared towards entertainment than competition. So the attitude towards solo queue is going to be much more about like having fun. You know, this is a game compared at the even at the highest level compared to some of the regions.
That's really interesting that they maybe treat it more as a traditional sport. Like, I mean, they're going after it like it's an Olympic event or very, very interesting. So I want to get back into this, but I want to start where you started and you can tell me where that is. But I just know from my background research, you got honors in economics at the University of Chicago. Yes. How do you get from there to here? Just start at the beginning, if you will.
Sure. So I graduated from University of Chicago and I worked at the IMF for a while. And there were a lot of things going on there that kind of made me not want to continue to pursue that. But at the
like
same time,
IMF. International Monetary Fund. Very cool. You just buried the lead there. That's pretty cool.
And so I kind of started writing about League of Legends esports, professional League of Legends esports, doing some analytical work and also some storytelling. I was very, very involved with the Chinese League of Legends scene and being interested in that and talking about it because not a lot of people were talking about it at the time, even though they were probably like the second strongest based on international performances.
So how did that happen? How did you get really deep into the Chinese League of Legends scene?
I mean, I just started watching it in the middle of the night and writing about it. I've always been someone who really likes writing and writing about my interests. So I started doing that. And then I very easily kind of got picked up by certain publications just because no one was writing about the Chinese scene. So it was interesting, you know, at first, and no one was doing it.
It's like you were a beat writer and they were your beat. Very cool.
After a while, it was sort of clear that even though there wasn't like a lot of following in the English speaking audience for the Chinese scene, so I had to sort of branch out and I started covering Europe as well. I spent a lot of time living in China, transitioning into that after, because I started writing full time for The Score. That was after I went to Chicago and worked at Morningstar as well for a while, which is an economic data packaging research for, you know.
They rank all your investments,
stocks,
right?
Investments, right? Yeah. So I worked there for a while on ETFs, and then I continued sort of pursuing this. And eventually I got an offer to work full-time for The Score, which is a sports publication or sports app in Canada. And then I used that sort of segue and say, I'm just going to go to China. So I spent a couple of years in China.
You just moved to China. You didn't have to, but you used it because you may as well be there to cover it.
Yeah.
That's so cool, Kelsey.
And I forced myself to kind of learn the language so I could do interviews and stuff like that. So that's really where I got started. And then after that, like I was with a bunch of different esports companies that sort of just fell, like collapsed just because the ad revenue is not there and the story's like this in every media venture, right? Mm-hmm. And then I was between places and I got offered, kind of, and I was able to support myself freelance full time, you know, working with like ESPN and a couple of other places.
Still just writing?
Yeah. And then doing like videos on my own and stuff like that. and then I finally got an offer to work for a European team. And so I transitioned to coaching that way.
Was that H2K?
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. Well, I want to go back and fill in some of the gaps here because obviously you had a lot of options. I mean, IMF, Morningstar, these are like the dream jobs of probably a lot of your classmates in the University of Chicago in economics. Where did the passion for League of Legends come from?
Well, it was just I had a friend. I don't know if you're familiar with Roskren.
Not yet. I hope I get to be.
She's a color commentary for the LEC, and we were friends for a while just outside of League. And then
is she the actress?
really, really into it. She's not an actress, no.
Okay, I'm getting her mixed up. Sorry.
But she was really, really interested in League of Legends, and she tried to go pro, actually, for a while. She was climbing and grinding. And then she just sort of transitioned into casting while I was doing journalism, and we lived together, and we basically just kind of shared things and bounced off each other. And when I got into the Chinese scene, she sort of followed me into it and started doing commentary for that. So it was kind of just like a project stemmed from that kind of relationship. So
that's it. So you weren't like a big League of Legends player. You just happened to know somebody who was doing the casting, and it worked out that way.
I used to play with her a lot and stuff, and I wasn't really like super into it. As soon as I learned that there was a competitive scene, like, I basically cared way less about playing, and I was like, I'd rather just watch and learn from and study like the highest level that I possibly can. Right.
That's so interesting.
That's what I started doing instead.
Is this like kind of part of your personality? Do you normally like throw yourself into things like that?
I'm not sure about that one. It's just, I guess with this, I think for most of when I was younger, I just tried to do very, very safe things. Mm-hmm. And then I was definitely set on, like, from a young age pursuing like a PhD in economics and going on that route. But then it was just this sort of came in the way, and I started just going more and more in this direction. And it's a new thing. It's riskier, right? And there's way less support. Like, I was with Score, I was with Yahoo, and both of those companies sort of went down within a year of each other. And so I started, like, ESPN is the only one that's really stable. So I started writing freelance for them and a couple of other places, and just all the freelance publications kept changing because those kept collapsing, right, over and over again. So it's just one would go up, I would sustain off of that for a while, and then another, almost like a weird Ponzi scheme feeding into each other.
Just hopping from one day.
So it was kind of like that, and it was much more tumultuous, right? And I would say that being in coaching is even more risky. It's just because, like, things could go wrong very easily. You could have a bad split for X, Y, and Z, and then suddenly you just don't have a position anymore, right? So I think that's something that I wanted to take more risks, you know? I wanted to try more things. There are a couple of times where I think I had people who were, like, a little bit dependent on me. I was, like, helping friends out financially, and so I was really, really risk-averse. Partly because of that. And so when I was on my own, it was just kind of like, all right, let's just jump head first, see where this goes. And if it doesn't go very far, I'll figure that out too.
And it took you all the way to China, which is pretty amazing. So I guess you gain a reputation for yourself covering the league. People start to get to know you. How does the opportunity with H2K come about? Because it seems like, I mean, you're in the same industry, esports, but it seems like a totally different job. Is that, am I reading that right?
So, yeah, I think just because League of Legends esports is so new, like, I watched the idea of a League of Legends coach pop up after I had started, you know, covering it. So it was something new, and suddenly people were looking for people who could fill that position. And I was approached multiple times, and those were during some of those times where I was more risk averse, so I didn't really take them. But it was always interesting to me. It's like, if you come out of nowhere and just start writing blogs on the internet from a point where it seems like you're authoritative, right? People will start to believe you, so, whether or not you actually are. And then it's a matter of who gets eyes on X, Y, and Z. And if all of my content was very kind of analytic focused on, like, they play the game this way because of this. So that's why I was offered first, like, an analyst position, and then that transitioned to an assistant coaching role for H2K. And eventually, after H2K didn't make it into the franchising in Europe, I ended up getting an offer from 100 Thieves. So.
Very cool. So your economics background, is that kind of really played into your getting into the analysis and then now into coaching?
Yes and no. So I would say that there are certain things like the program Stata. I don't know if you're aware of the program Stata, but that's a program that I've used for ages, right? Just to manage data in my jobs and while I was in school working on my economics projects and everything else. And that was a tool that allowed me to manage data very easily. So if I was like hand taking data from Chinese League of Legends games, just because there was no really easily accessible website that did it for most of the other leagues. So I was hand doing that and I was managing those packages and doing those types of analysis. There were a bunch of different analytical projects that I've always kind of started and stopped. But I would say that that hasn't necessarily been my driving force. I think part of the problem with esports media is that it's just very immediate. Like there isn't a lot of room for very big projects because people's eyes are jumping from thing to thing to thing. And it's almost like you're incentivized to spend less time on an article or a video because really the only thing people look at is the headline. So as long as the topic itself like engenders discussion, you can write like five sentences on it and then it'll be front page of Reddit and it'll do way better than something that you've spent months researching and putting together. So it's a little bit of that, but I've always kind of had the idea of like, I could do really big data projects with this game. If I ever wanted to go back to economics, like there are a lot of economic driven projects that I could actually do on esports, right?
Yeah.
So ideas like that have occasionally come up.
Does it play in at all to scouting? Like I'm thinking Moneyball in baseball, you know, it's like people, and part of it's the eye test, part of it's like this data and different people are looking at different things. Is everyone in League of Legends looking at the same players? How do you differentiate when you're scouting? And does your economics background play into that at all?
So there's definitely a Moneyball is like a very hot topic in esports just because the game itself is constantly changing. There's a new patch every couple of weeks. So specific data points on damage of certain builds or certain champions, like the character you're playing when you load into the game is different every game as well. So it's hard to get consistent data on consistent patches.
Right. Very different from baseball that's been the same for 100 years.
So yeah, it's really difficult to do stuff like that. I think there's more work going into making comprehensive like data crunching like that, but most of the quote unquote moneyballing that you could do is really limited. A lot of it is also down to like a concept called minion waves. I don't know how much League of Legends you watch or play, but creeps like kind of walk out of the base toward the lane, and a lot of it goes around like controlling that wave or getting creeps off of that. So if you're not able to use a computer to sort of track the position of the wave as well, you can't necessarily understand the decision making that goes into some of the things that they're doing. So there's a lot of like image recognition work, I think, that's sort of been going on to track like minion wave states and stuff like that. So I would say I personally am not super involved in that, but just most of my scouting I do is eye test. Like I watch a ton of games and take a ton of notes. I might take like handwritten, I might do like hand taken data, like things like, oh, what does this guy do off of this movement, right?
Yeah.
And then I try to find consistent patterns in that based on those data points. But most of the scouting work I do is eye test based.
Are you looking at people just on your third tier team? Or are you looking at everybody?
Oh, yeah. I look at a lot of different people. So I think for me, having like a full North American team is sort of important at the academy and amateur level, just for development purposes, just because there are restrictions on how many players you can import on the main league. So I try to, like, I look at the server, I look at other teams. We just kind of try to look at that. Obviously, ideally, we would want to set up our players to move on to the next level and be in the best position to do that. But it really kind of depends on the situation, right? So.
Yeah. How do you approach someone if you decide that you think they'd be great in the academy? How's that approach? Are you usually one of several teams that are approaching them? I want to know all about it.
Yeah, all sorts of things. So it's a bunch, like I use Twitter most frequently because I don't play that much or I don't use the game client that much, but I'll have coaches who work in the org. If they don't have a Twitter, then I'll have like one of the coaches add them on the client. It will have like a recognizable name and then we'll have a conversation. Maybe I'll watch more of their games. Sometimes the footage is really limited for like scouting of amateur players. You can only go by what they're doing in solo queue. So stuff like that will happen. We'll bring them, like we did an in-house event last year where we brought in players to try out kind of for our academy team. And we brought in five players and we had them do like a bunch of in-houses with our existing academy team just to see, kind of get a feel for what the talent looked like. So we do a lot of stuff like that, because I think it's also very important to have players come in and be able to kind of see how you would work with them and see what you can kind of bring out of them in a short amount of time to have a really good idea of whether or not they'd be a good academy asset.
Wow. I would think that most people would be really excited to hear from you. Is that generally the case?
Most of the players?
Yeah. Yeah. Like if all of a sudden it's like you're getting picked up for the big, son.
Yeah, I think so. If they're grinding really, really hard and they really want to make it, like right now we have a top winner who just turned 17 on our amateur team, who says that, you know, if you told me I could have an academy position, I'd go right now. I wouldn't finish high school, like all these things. But there are varying degrees of enthusiasm, because obviously there's also another player on that team who's kind of like doing very well in school and is sort of weighing the ideas of following that and having obviously parents who don't want them to be involved in esports, which is very sane, very rational, right? And I would tell most parents to not really encourage their players to commit to professional video game or try to pursue that, because it's very difficult and very selective. So, but I think it's a mix of things, right? But I think most players who are putting in a lot of work, grinding a lot, would be very excited to have an offer to go to an academy team in North America.
That's very cool. So let's bounce back to you going to H2K. So you make this decision. How much of it was, let's go to Europe now? And how much of it was, let's try something new? This was it started out as an analyst position, right?
Yeah. So like I said, I've been kind of given offers to work for teams in the past, but all of these are very, very unstable sort of offers. And I, at the time, was also like helping some friends full time in terms of financial aid. So I didn't really want to quit my full time jobs to follow that at the time. And it was just, this was a situation where, okay, I just moved to Yahoo off of the score. Like they had kind of poached me, and then Yahoo went down within 6 months of me joining them. So then
it's not your fault, Kelsey.
Yeah. And then I was just doing a bunch of different freelance gigs or freelance jobs. I'd spent a lot of time in Berlin, which is where the European League is hosted. And I had done interviews there, talked to a lot of players there about the game, because kind of part of when I joined the score and did full time, they said, you can't just write about China because that doesn't get hits. People don't care. So I sort of became like, or Europe kind of became my second beat. And I had very good connections with a lot of different teams there. I would argue that probably I covered North America the least, despite being from the U.S. I ended up spending time in Europe, and I spent a full year there in Germany working for H2K. I guess the decision was just always, I'd always been interested in coaching, but I'd never, the timing had never been good for it, so.
What was the biggest adjustment when you became a coach? Because, I mean, most of your players, mm-hmm. like you were just talking about, are right at that kind of high school going into college age, right?
Yes. So I guess obviously at the higher level, you have people who are like more, it ranges between like 17 is the minimum age to like 24 or something like that. So depends on, you get a variety of different levels of age. Yeah. And we had like a 17-year-old AD carry and on that team, as well as like a couple of 22-year-old players. So we had, a little bit of depth of age range. But I think the biggest adjustment is kind of, for me, one thing is just, I went from like way less public. So that happened almost immediately. I spent so much of my day as a journalist just on social media mm-hmm. and talking to people and doing all these things. And it was much more like kind of in on myself. Like I was more guarded about what I knew or what I thought, and ended up having to transition to, it's very different talking to people on Reddit who don't know as much about the game or as in depth about the game to professional players. So you have to be much more careful.
I can tell you the same with Survivor, Kelsey. These Survivor fans on Reddit, you try to tell them, they just don't understand.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to be like way more careful and way more prepared for this counter argument, this thing as well, when you're talking to pro players as compared to people like on the internet who don't know as much, who sort of accept you already as an authority. So it was much more about thinking about how I'm phrasing things and becoming better at being interpersonal, which I'm not the most interpersonal individual. So that was more the challenge, was kind of the social aspects of coaching. That's going forward into that, as opposed to just some of the other things.
Do most people want to be coached? I was talking with Loco Doco, like I said before, and he had mentioned that he thought it was going to be a lot of X's and O's in coaching, and it ended up being so much about managing personalities. Mm-hmm. What's the range from don't want to be coached at all, stay out of my face, hard to work with, to really wants to soak it up, wants to learn everything they can from you?
So I would argue that no one doesn't want to be coached, right? And anyone who has the desire to get better wants help from whoever will make it. Even if it seems like all you can offer them is advice on what they're building, they'll take that, right? They just want it from somewhere. And I think one of the biggest things is just making it clear that you're working as hard or harder than them, right? You have to commit to being at the office before them, staying later at the office than they do, so that they really get the idea that you're as committed to their improvement as you are. Just like these kinds of clues and hints, I think, to make people feel like at least you're working hard. I mean, I think the biggest one is don't make things worse, right? So when I first got into coaching, obviously I wasn't as, I wasn't really experienced at all in that type of thing. And I had to basically just kind of observe and learn for much of my first year. I was much more on the analyst role before I started like working individually one-on-one with like our junglers. Was the biggest thing I did. But I think much of my first time on H2K was, okay, I'm taking data and I'm putting reports together in the morning for the head coach to look at. And I'm just trying to absorb like how the practice works and how people are learning things. So the idea is the first rule of coaching is like, don't make it worse, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have nothing useful to add, don't feel pressured to add it. A lot of times, like, the best thing you can do is guide them into having a conversation, because obviously you're not going to be in the game talking to them while they're playing. They have to know this stuff, right? They have to know it well. So if you can guide them to a point where they're figuring it out on their own, a lot of times that's going to be way more helpful than you just like sitting at the review and telling them, this is how you fucked up, this is what was wrong, do this the next time instead, right? So just allowing them to have a conversation and get to something as a team can be way more impactful than just knowing everything about the game. And that was something that I had to figure out and learn, I think.
It sounds like H2K was a terrific learning experience, that you got a whole lot out of it.
I got a whole lot out of it. It didn't end very well. I don't know if you checked the scores, but I personally got a whole lot out of the experience. I feel kind of a lot of regret for what happened to some of the players, right? I feel like every time you're on a team like that, if it doesn't go well, a lot of times that can be a career ender, right? So I personally got a whole lot out of it. And like every time I let players down, like I'll always take that as a motivation to just work harder and be better at what I'm doing. So.
Do you face any unique challenges or any benefits from being a woman in esports?
I don't know. It's really difficult to quantify exactly because I don't have the experience of being a man in esports.
Right.
I would say that there's good and bad things. I think that you can have a different sort of relationship with players as a coach. I think as a man, like, players sort of expect you to be way more authoritative, like way, like kind of hench, to go to the gym all the time, to be like a harsh dad who like yells at them, whereas I think they expect more like kind of a motherly side, or like more of a nurturing aspect from like a female in the same position probably. So I think that like finding the balance in that is something unique that I get to figure out. And then in terms of writing and everything else and being a personality, obviously there's like sexual harassment that comes with it. But I also think that there's like, you kind of stand out naturally, right? So there's like good and bad things that come with it.
I'm looking at it from the perspective of like, you know, a lot of this Esports for Beginners podcast is about how esports is very similar to traditional sports. Mm-hmm. And there are people in traditional sports that claim that male athletes won't listen to a woman coach. And you're just now getting like, you're just now getting women coaching, you know, in smaller positions in the NFL, in the NBA. Is this something you guys talk about? I mean, do you feel like you're paving the way a little bit?
I guess yes and no. I think that obviously in a major league working for a major team, I'm the only League of Legends female coach, right? So that's in academy or major or minor leagues. But I think that something that it doesn't really come up, right? People don't really point out, oh, you're a woman or anything like that, right?
That's great. I mean, that shows that it's just kind of like ahead of the curve.
I show up and we talk as a team and they just accept like kind of what I'm giving them. I don't think like maybe there's some stuff that, you know, I wouldn't be able to know. I wouldn't be able to compare it to anything else. But I think it hasn't so far been a problem with players, at least. I would say like sometimes management will have some questions, right? Like management will are more likely to have the bias of how much will my players listen to this person, right? Or are more likely to think, okay, is it going to be distracting for a woman to be in a room full of boys, right? So I think that those questions are more likely to come up. I experienced it a little bit without going into detail, but I would say that there are others who have experienced it more. Like there are a lot of content leads who are female or who are women in esports. So a lot of people involved in producing like videos for the team or like really professional type skits or stuff to do with branding and negotiating and liaisoning with the brands and sponsors who are women. And there have been a lot more questions and stuff like that because I think part of the fact that I'm a bit older helps. Obviously, now that I'm
just
in my
the 30s, experience,
right? Well, I'm in my 30s, right? So people are much less likely to say something like, okay, a 30-plus-year-old woman is going to be like sexually distracting, which I think is really, really unfair to them anyway, right? I think that they're more than capable of focusing on the game, right? They're not just testosterone-filled, crazy.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that the concerns of management don't match up with your experience with the players, that when you get in the same room, that is not, you know, like you said, these are human beings that want to play the game and want to learn.
I mean, I'm sure it's the same in every single field, right? Mm-hmm. There's never been a situation where, like, when women entered any field, like now you see much more mixed workplaces, sexually mixed workplaces, where it's not a question of, oh, can a man and a woman work together in a hedge fund or something like that, right? That doesn't really come up. It's just like, can a woman and a man work together in esports, right? I think that,
right.
It's weird that like it has to be a question every new field, but it's something that I think I've experienced way more coming from management or people actually outside of esports coming in. So I had one person who was at H2K actually was experienced in an experience that, in a business that wasn't esports and was like one of the major financial contributors who like had some of the most resistance to me being there. But not really someone who came up through esports or who was super familiar and ingrained in esports. So it was an interesting situation.
There you go. Esports may be a little bit ahead of the curve on some of these things, at least on the player
level. Yeah, I would say that I've maybe been fortunate.
So. Well, I appreciate the perspective. I appreciate you getting into that a little bit with me. You mentioned that you covered North America less than any of the other leagues, and you really got deep in with China and the European leagues, I guess. Yeah. So what's the relationship with you and some pro North American fans?
So it was really interesting because I think when I was doing content, I had this brand of she hates North America just because I was constantly like down on North American performances, right?
You leaned into it, right?
And I kind of accepted it and just took it. And Travis Gafford, who's like the major interviewer from the North American scene, interviewed me about it when I ended up coaching in North America. I was like, do you hate North America? Are you? It's just like, no, I think, part of me is just, I just want them to be better. than they are, right? I want the North American teams to actually be good. And the fact that they aren't, I'm not going to lie about it. So it's also like it's really easy to kind of lean into the jokes and some of the things that lend themselves from as a pundit to like bad performing teams, right? So
karma works its way out, and then all of a sudden, you are working for a North American team. Was that the next job, going from H2K to 100 Thieves? Were you right away the academy director and head coach there? Mm-hmm. So what was that decision process like? Who approached you? How did that all work out?
So I was approached by Jackson, who is one of the main, I guess, figureheads in the business side of 100 Thieves. I think his official title is head of business development now, but at that time he was basically wearing all of the hats, right? He was the GM, he was doing so much, like in charge of every team. And so we ended up hiring like a full GM for all of esports. And then later, like a League of Legends specific GM. So you kind of think that Jackson at the time was doing the job of all of those jobs that were created since I joined. But I think he was the one who reached out to me, and he initially reached out to me to contract me for some scouting work, right? They were looking at rebuilding the team after some of the issues that happened in 2018. And I like kind of contributed some of my thoughts on that, but I would say the process itself was really disorganized. We didn't necessarily do a good job that year, and then he ended up offering me the position. So that was I think it was just like he actively was looking to include me. There were a couple of other offers for interviews that I had at the time, but none of them that really like kind of incorporated me into the process of the team building and everything from the beginning. So that's why 100 Thieves was immediately the most appealing. So
that's very cool. There are a lot of, I'm trying to think, Bill Parcells, a famous NFL coach, said he only wanted to coach the team, you know, if he could pick the players. And he said he only wanted to cook the meal if he could buy the groceries. Mm-hmm. How much different is that experience versus what you had at H2K?
So I was part of the roster building process at the time. I talked extensively with the head coach, and obviously that was an organization that was kind of looking not super competitively at players. It was mostly looking at, these are the players we can get to compete for now, because we kind of want to save money going into the franchising process. We want our books to look good, right?
Right.
So this was the idea behind that. So there was a lot kind of, we weren't necessarily chasing high dollar names. We were just looking to see the best pieces that we could put together. And I think we did a pretty good job. I don't think that those players were weak, any of the players that we worked with. It's just that it ended up, the roster or the performance ended up being like less than the sum of its parts. So that was rather unfortunate. And I really wish, like, again, as I've said, that those players could have more chances if they wanted them. So it was a similar experience. Like, I would say both teams I was on, I ended up having some input. I've had input on the LCS side. I had final say both splits of the academy roster. I had kind of a weird approach last year, which was we just took 4 out of 5 members of the team from Scouting Grounds and paired them with a veteran player from the previous academy roster. And went with that as kind of an experiment. We ended up retaining 3 of them going forward, and then the veteran ended up promoted to the LCS roster. So
that's really interesting. How important is it to get players? I'm again thinking of minor league traditional sports. There's a lot of players that just want to show how great they are individually so that they get moved up. But you're still trying to fit them in within a team. And it's like sometimes you need to do a little less of what you do great for the benefit of the team. Is it hard to find that mix between players wanting to win for the academy team versus wanting to show that they're ready for the LCS team?
So I think it's a little bit weird because I would say that scouting is still really lazy overall. So sometimes the best way to demonstrate that you're LCS ready is to win academy, right? So a lot of times those things align. I think that because there isn't a lot of extensive scouting done on like lower tier academy teams, so you have to be willing to do what you can to win. And I think that it's there are different definitely different objectives, right? Because the academy level is much less about winning and much more about preparing players for X, Y, and Z. So I think one thing that we've wanted to focus on is like finding a balance there and defining what exactly that means. But it is a very interesting space to be in, because I think that a lot of coaches also even see academy as a stepping stone, right? As not mm-hmm. something that they're super invested in being in. Like, it's something I wanted because I think that one of North America's biggest issues is our talent development side and the programs that we have that allow players to eventually get to the LCS level, because we have a lot of older players. We're not seeing like the same transference of rookies that a lot of other regions are seeing, just because, again, like the solo queue environment is not very good at self-teaching.
Is that rewarding to be able to address some of those issues that you brought up in your previous analysis work?
I think it is and it isn't. Like, it's obviously completely different from expectations. I think finding exactly what needs to be taught or what players need to know to get better to get to the LCS level is difficult. But it's definitely interesting and rewarding. Like, I would say it's very rewarding to see improvements when they occur.
Are there any things that you've borrowed from what you saw in the Chinese leagues or the European leagues?
Yes and no. I think that obviously what I've learned from coaches, because I've talked to a lot of coaches in other regions, something I've tried to incorporate. And then obviously we always take game footage from leagues or teams that are better than ours and use that as a tool to teach like concepts and techniques. So there's always a little bit of that. Yeah.
What do you like most about your job?
I mean, I think there's a lot of things I like. I would say probably the best feeling is when players show improvement. I think that that's like probably the best part of it. And it's when you see players show improvement and you know that maybe it's not because of you, but at least you've created an environment where they can, right? Like, that's always a good feeling.
And what's the toughest part of the job or the part that you just wish you could give to somebody else?
I mean, losing sucks.
So, yeah, I'd give away.
Going off of a loss is always like the worst feeling, I think, in the job.
What's it like interacting with social media? I've asked this for everybody, and I've gotten really mixed results.
Interacting with social media?
Yeah, I've gotten from gamers that it can be a little rough. I've gotten shoutcasters that it can be great. And everyone agrees that it's hard not to concentrate on the negative. What's your experience?
Yeah, obviously I was way more focused on and cared way more about social media when I was in media, because like appealing to the masses was sort of my responsibility and job. Right. And I spent a lot of time interacting with people on Reddit and Twitter. I have to remind myself now to tweet, you know, just so that I don't disappear. I have like 20,000 plus followers, you know, it's just, and so social media right now is, excuse me, something that I concern myself with way less than before. I think it's important, right? It's very important because we have to remind ourselves that we are an entertainment industry. So any player who says that they just want to tunnel it out and not interact with it is not doing themselves a service to their career, unfortunately. So I think, just being present, making sure that you're one. I think esports is very unique right now in that we have streaming and you're able to, while you sort of practice on your own time, talk to your fans and show them exactly what you're doing. And there's a lot more opportunity for interaction. So I think that that's something that has kind of made the space very unique, very fun kind of place to be. So I think that, there's definitely negatives for sure. Like, it sucks when you're getting tweeted at after a loss that like X, Y, and Z is your fault by multiple people. But
yeah, so you hear it from fans if you win or if you lose.
But I think it's just part of the whole package that makes esports unique. So I try not to see if it as inherently bad or good. It's just there.
Do you have any rivalries for your squad, or does 100 Thieves as a whole have a big rival? I'm really curious about that. I hear the rivalries are alive and well in esports.
Oh yeah, they are. I think 100 Thieves is a newer team in the LCS space, so we've only been part of it since franchising started 3 years ago. And I think, or I guess 2.5, I'm thinking of 2020 as already complete when we haven't even started the summer split yet. But I think there's like much more of a direct rivalry between 100 Thieves and another team, and much more of just like 100 Thieves is kind of differentiated themselves in a way that makes them really, really appealing from a brand perspective. So we're able to compete as a brand with some of the more entrenched organizations like TSM and CLG. And so that's interesting. I wouldn't say that there's a direct rivalry. I think last year was kind of interesting because we had two quarterfinals against Echo Fox Academy, which is an organization that's no longer in LCS, unfortunately, but we had two quarterfinals against them that went to 5 games, and neither team won a blue side game that entire either series, so that felt a little bit like a rivalry. So I think that because like in spring, obviously, we lost the coin toss, and so we had 3 red side games, and in summer, we won, and we had 3 blue side games, so we won summer, and we lost to them in spring. So it was a bit of an interesting one. So I think stuff like that pops up, but right now there's not a really clear, defined 100 Thieves rivalry. So.
Very nice. So right now, you're just getting ready for the season. Is there anything big coming up for you or your squad or for 100 Thieves that you want to tell us about?
Just support the players in going into summer. Fake God, Contracts, Ligo, Prismal, and Breeze are all very hard work and focused on improving. So if you take a moment to watch some of our games and follow them on Twitter, I'm sure that would be great for them. So
outstanding. And where can we follow you on Twitter, Kelsey?
K-A-R-O-N-M-O-S-E-R. My middle name is Aaron, spelled A-R-O-N, so that's why it's like that. But my name is not Karen, it's Kelsey. So.
And she will try to remember to tweet to you.
Yes, exactly.
I will she's try. Got I bigger think, fish to fry.
Yeah, LPL finals are about to be up, and I'm going to do a show with ESPN to talk about the Chinese League of Legends final tomorrow, I think. So that'll be a fun one.
Very excited. Yeah, well, we'll definitely keep up with that. Very cool, Kelsey. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you very much. Have a great day.
You got it. And a big thanks to Rob Sesternino and Scott St. Pierre. Our next episode will be coming to you soon. Keep an eye out for it. I hope to see you in the real world real soon.